Lecture 20. From the Archaic to the Classical Period.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello. And so the Persian Wars came to an end, with the Greeks completely victorious and the Persians completely defeated. In the first part of this lecture, I want to discuss the aftermath of the Persian Wars and ask a number of questions. Questions such as who is responsible for defeating the Persians and the extent to which the Persians themselves contributed to their loss. You've probably already formed your own opinions, which is great, I commend you. But as you'll see, even the most straightforward of questions can turn into a can of worms as we try to answer it. But this is what makes ancient history fascinating and fun. There's no such thing as a right or wrong answer to virtually everything. In the second part of my lecture, I want to discuss whether the Persian Wars end the Archaic period and are the prelude to the classical, as I've been saying, or whether they start the classical period proper. Now, this is important. It's important not just for how we look at the wars, how historians write about them, but it's important because how the ancient Greeks saw them. So let's begin with the aftermath of the Persian Wars and then go on to the questions. Because it was the victory at Plataea that actually caused the Persians to leave Greek soil, it was resolved by the Hellenic League. Remember, that's the combination of 31 states that got together in 481 to resist Persia. The Hellenic League resolved to make the site of the battle sacred ground, and it was dedicated to Zeus. I'm not entirely sure how well this would have sat with the Athenians, given that it was the Spartans who played the key role in defeating Mardonius and the Persians at Plataea. Nevertheless, any grumbles that the Athenians might have had were kept muffled in the interests of thanking the gods. Tensions between Athens and Sparta were already starting to mount. I mentioned this in the last lecture, and these tensions are not going to get any better. For example, with the defeat of the Persians, Themistocles had ordered the rebuilding of the city's fortification walls. Now, these had been destroyed the previous year when the Persians had first seized Athens. Themistocles had persuaded the Athenians in the assembly that the city walls should be rebuilt. The Spartans, however, had apparently sent an embassy to Athens protesting the refortification of the city. Obviously, they wanted to check Athenian power as much as possible. And if a city did not have a fortification wall, then it was clearly vulnerable to attack. The Spartan argument was that no city, not just Athens, but no city outside of the Peloponnese should be walled. They said that if any city were taken by the Persians in any renewed attack on Greece, then it could be used as a Persian stronghold. So this is an argument then really for only a select number of cities within the Peloponnese that, remember, the Spartans controlled, that only a select number of cities should be walled. Now this is nonsense, of course, and needless to say, the Athenians were completely unmoved by the Spartan arguments. And as a result, they were quick to finish refortifying the city. Individual league members, that's members of the Hellenic League of 481, as well as private individuals from other states, were quick to set up artworks at Delphi as thank you gifts for the god, delivering them from Persian domination. The piety of the Greeks then is illustrated one more time. Instead of setting up thank you memorials in their city marketplaces or something like that, they set up memorials at Delphi as a thank offering to Apollo. The league itself also set up a victory monument at Delphi. This was a bronze one, and it was dedicated to Apollo, of course, since it was set up at Delphi. It consisted of three intertwined serpents carved on it with the names of the 31 states of the League. And the names of Athens and Sparta were prominently displayed at the top of the list. Herodotus says that the bronze for this serpent column, as it became known, came from the melted down weapons of the Persians at Plataea. These the Greeks had seized as spoils of war after the battle. Now I like to think, and I'm sure this ran through some ancient Greek minds too, that the Greeks were smiling inwardly a lot when they made this dedication, this serpent column. Because when Xerxes had first invaded Greece in 481, a number of Greek states had gone to consult the Delphic Oracle to ask what to do, and Apollo had predicted only doom and gloom for Greece. In fact, the Oracle told the Athenians, for example, that they should pack everything up and move out west. There wasn't any point in resisting the Persians. Now the Greeks had defeated the Persians, so the irony of setting up a victory monument in Delphi would not have been lost on anyone. This monument, by the way, you can see today in a square called the Hippodrome in Istanbul, of all places. How on earth did it end up there? Well, it was taken from Delphi in the year 324 AD by the Roman Emperor Constantine, and he took it to Constantinople, which became, of course, the modern Istanbul. There was still the matter of the states that had Medized during the wars themselves, in particular Thebes. And so, after Plataea, various mopping up operations were conducted against these Medi states. Thebes was too powerful, and Boeotia was in much too much of an important location in central Greece to be allowed to stay pro-Persian. Boeotia bordered directly on Attica. And of course, Thebes had Medized during the Persian Wars as well. So that meant that it was essential at least to win Boeotia back onto the Greek side. So the Greeks besieged Thebes. And after 20 days, the mass of the Thebans in the city had had enough and they surrendered. The pro-Persian ringleaders were handed over to the League and they were executed. Moves were also made to erode Persian bases elsewhere, including the islands of the Aegean and as far east as Asia Minor. It's interesting that Herodotus ends his account of the Persian Wars with the siege and liberation of Sestos. Control of the seas was now back in Greek hands once the Athenians had won over Sestos. So perhaps Herodotus saw the siege of Sestos and then the accompanying ascendancy at sea again as marking the actual end of the Persian Wars. Whether that means Herodotus saw Sestos and not battles like Plataea and Mycale as marking Xerxes' actual defeat is another thing. In truth, we don't know why Herodotus ended his account with Sestos. Anybody who says he or she does know is telling fibs. But Herodotus knew what he was doing. He had to have a reason to end his histories with Sestos. This wasn't an accident. And I wonder whether Athenian naval ascendancy has a lot to do with it. Because Athens would use the Persian Wars to launch a league of its own, one that was naval. That made it different from Sparta's Peloponnesian League. Herodotus lived through all this. He could see what naval power provided for Athens after Sestos. So I wonder if it's sort of his way of saying, well, after Sestos, there's only one thing left for the Athenians to do, and that's get a league together. But I'm really not interested in writing about that, so I'll stop now. You can't prove me wrong. And remember what I said before, there's no right or wrong answer. Herodotus ultimately explained Xerxes' defeat as having to do with his arrogance or hubris. Hubris is a peculiar concept that the Greeks had to keep mortals from overstepping the line, to keep mortals from putting themselves on a par with the gods in their thoughts and in their actions. Now, I mentioned Xerxes' arrogance last time and how Herodotus said that Persia was fated to lose the Persian Wars because of Xerxes' arrogance, his hubris. And I'd like to return to that point now for the next minute or two. For Herodotus, Xerxes was doomed to failure the moment he bridged the Hellespont. And this is right at the start of the war. In fact, this is even before he first set foot in Greece proper. Bridging the Hellespont with that pontoon bridge of boats, that was a magnificent achievement. But in doing so, he overstepped the line. He angered the gods. Because what he'd done, in effect, was that he had tamed the water. He'd done something to that stretch of water that no man was supposed to do. Now, the Greeks understood about hubris, and they were very careful not to commit it. Even a question as casual as, hey, do you think it will rain tomorrow, might be avoided because, well, can humans foresee the future? Not even modern-day meteorologists can. This is the preserve of the gods, whether it's the weather or anything else. So Herodotus would not have been seen as a crackpot in his view. That's his view of saying that Xerxes was always going to be defeated because of his hubris. Hubris has these religious overtones that we find also making their way into later forensic speeches, the speeches of the law courts. It's a noun, and then in its verbal form, to commit hubris, these words are used against opponents in a law court to stir the jury against them. So it's a very loaded word indeed. But the reason Herodotus put forward for Xerxes' defeat, his hubris, so it was divine plan that he was always going to be defeated, that reason was very likely to have been downplayed in places like Sparta and Athens, wasn't it? When you consider the military roles they played in defeating the Persians, whether it's at Salamis or at Plataea, they would very well not want to put the spotlight on the gods. If Athens was fated to win at Salamis, well, that takes away some of the limelight from them, doesn't it? Themistocles, fantastic victory, says the Athenians. And then Themistocles says, well, you know, I was always going to be victorious because the gods had said so. The Persian Wars era raises a number of questions that have a bearing on the classical period that follows it, and especially on the future relations between Athens and Sparta. These are the two big powers now of the Greek mainland. The Athenians have now become a player on the Greek scene. Perhaps the most obvious question, and this is not a modern one, though modern historians pose it, it's a question that something Greeks at the time were thinking about, is whether Athens or Sparta deserves more credit for defeating Persia, because both sides claim credit for this. Well, what do the ancients think? Well, Herodotus states boldly that the Athenians saved Greece. He says that if it hadn't been for Salamis, all would have been lost. He goes on to say that not even if the Spartans had set up fortifications along the isthmus, would they have been able to check the Persians. The Spartans are tough fighters, he admits, but they wouldn't have defeated the Persians. Thankfully, according to Herodotus, the Athenians fought at Salamis. And as a result, they saved Greece. Herodotus actually says that. The Athenians saved Greece. Herodotus is referring to the dilemma that the Greeks faced before Salamis. That is when Eurybiades and the Peloponnesians were in favor of splitting up and going back to defend their homes. Themistocles prevented this, remember, by forcing the battle at Salamis. Is Herodotus right? As we said in our last lecture, he may well be using some pro-Themistoclean tradition here in his account, and it's this tradition that elevates Themistocles' role at Salamis, and by necessity, it would have to downplay that of the Spartans. At the same time, there is no question that Salamis was pivotal in the Persian Wars. I mean, thanks to it, the Persian lines of communication were forever disrupted. Xerxes fled. He took the fleet with him. and the Persians who were left behind in Greece under the leadership of Mardonius had to have been badly affected by the great king's actions. Now, I'm confident that you're agreeing with me about all of this, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm equally confident that you'd also agree that without Salamis, there would not have been Plataea. Hence, can we say that ultimately it was the Athenians who contributed the most to defeating the Persians, because that victory at Salamis was masterminded by Themistocles? But Salamis didn't actually expel the Persians from Greek soil. Pivotal it may have been, I agree, and it did set up that final victory at Plataea, but it didn't technically end the threat from Persia. Mardonius was able to regroup during the winter, and he was able to force the Greeks to battle again the following year. This was the Battle of Plataea in 479. There was no indication after Salamis that Xerxes was not going to return, or at least send more troops to reinforce Mardonius. Any reinforcements need not be sent immediately. Mardonius had enough allies in the north to offer him shelter there, so he could have stayed up there almost forever. Or he could have nipped into Thrace. Remember, that was a Persian satrapy. So Xerxes could have formed new plans at his leisure and sent troops to reinforce Mardonius for another attack on the Greeks. That year, 2 years later, who knows? The Persian threat to Greece, and indeed the Persian presence in Greece, was obviously still considerable, because places like Thebes stayed loyal to the Persian cause. And Thebes even sent soldiers to support Mardonius when he had marched into Attica again in the spring of 479. Now, presumably, the Thebans wouldn't have done this. They wouldn't have sent reinforcements if they'd thought that Mardonius was a completely lost cause. They would have known that the other Greeks wouldn't take too kindly to their action. Then again, perhaps they had no choice, since they'd already Medized. That was not something the other Greeks would overlook when the war was over, not something they would forget. So they may have supported Mardonius as they did because of the position they were in. In other words, they had no choice, regardless of the outcome, rather than they did what they did. In other words, they reinforced Mardonius because they considered a Greek victory was a lost cause. What if Mardonius had won at Plataea? How different Greek, how different Persian history would have been. But he didn't win. And his loss at Plataea sent him and the remnants of his army fleeing for home. In this case, since Plataea was the final battle in the Persian wars on the mainland, not the final battle in the wars, remember Michele, but since Plataea was the final battle on the mainland, and given the role that Sparta played in it, can we therefore say that ultimately it was the Spartans who were responsible for the Persian defeat? Well, perhaps you're thinking that I'm being too black and white here, and that it's better to say that not one state, but all of them working together, defeated the Persians. That's fine. It's just that I don't like to fence it. Even when I'm wrong, at least I've got a position, and I do love to provoke people. What about the Persians themselves? Did they come prepared? To what extent did the Persians contribute to their defeat, to their eventual loss? Well, Xerxes placed a lot of importance in his fleet. He based his lines of communication in it. He didn't have a plan B. He didn't have an exit policy. So when bad weather and naval defeats devastated that fleet and interrupted his lines of communication, well, that made all of the Persians suffer. Also, only a fraction of the Persian infantry was of the best fighting stock, and the cavalry was useless in a narrow, prepared defense. Think of Thermopylae. It wasn't even deployed at Thermopylae. Finally, Xerxes' action in fleeing back to Persia leaving Mardonius behind with a far smaller force, was hardly good for morale and keeping alive the will to fight on against a combined Greek army on Greek soil. So the answer to the question is that on balance, the Persians were certainly not well prepared. It might seem a futile exercise to try to picture Greek history if events had gone the opposite way to what they did. I read an article once on what would have happened if Alexander the Great had actually died in the first battle he fought against the Persians. He nearly did. But this is make-believe. But in this case, in the case of the Persian Wars, I think it is valid to imagine what Greek history would have been like, because it shows us that practically everything we associate with Greek culture might not have been. There would have been no Delian League headed by Athens, which turned into a 5th century empire, as we'll see in the next few lectures. Probably there would have been no radical democracy in Athens, no rise of rhetoric, nor even the advances in the judicial system, which are all products of democracy. Drama, philosophy may also have suffered. They may never have been. After all, if Darius had intended to set up Hippias as his puppet ruler of Athens in 490, I'm pretty sure Xerxes would have done the same thing, but just with someone else. In light of all of this, the era of the Persian Wars is a crucially important one in Greek history, and there are very good reasons for seeing it as the end of one period, the Archaic, before the start of another very different one, the Classical. But there's a modern belief that assigns the Persian Wars to the start of the Classical period. Hence, the Archaic period actually ends before them. Which view is right? And does it really matter? Well, here I move to the second part of my lecture because I think it does matter. The rationale for putting the wars at the start of the Classical period, at least as far as I can see it, is that they herald a new dawn in the military history of Greece and the rise of imperialism. Because of this new dawn, they're on a par with the new things such as colonization and increased trade that characterized the 8th century Renaissance. And we know how that heralded the end of the Dark Ages and the start of the Archaic period. Well, we don't know what the Greeks themselves thought of the periods in their history. They did have them. But I happen to disagree with this modern periodization, I hate that word, this modern periodization that puts the Persian Wars at the start of the Classical period. I see the Persian Wars as a natural ending to the Archaic period, given its advances politically, culturally, artistically, and militarily. Athens's role in defeating the Persians provides the city with the means to launch its own league, and this will clash massively with Sparta. And it's this clash of the superpowers of Athens and Sparta that sets the tone for the Classical period. And it's not going to be a very nice tone. Now here, I'm disregarding artistic and intellectual advances in the Classical period. There's clearly a chasm of a difference between the early steps that were taken in the Archaic period and the fully mature forms that are also a characteristic of the Classical period. Think of early tragedy with Thespis in the Pisistrian Tyranny, and then the great tragedies of Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. But no one has really tried to date the Archaic and Classical periods based on, for example, developments in literary genres. And having said that, there's probably somebody writing a book on that right now. Now, I'm going to take a very different view of the Classical period here. And you might disagree with me, and I hope you do. We have this idea that the Classical period is serene and wonderful. It's the golden age of Greek civilization. The Archaic period is kind of like a prelude to it. It's necessary, but it's not as great as the Classical. Well, the Classical period was great, but it was only great, I would say, from the artistic, intellectual, and literary viewpoints. I think the Classical period is woeful compared to the Archaic, because of the military clashes. That sets the tone for the classical period, and it's as far removed from a golden age as you can think about. In the big picture, perhaps it doesn't matter whether the Persian Wars are archaic or classical. And to be honest, I get uncomfortable with the concept of periodization anyway. But uncomfortable or not, I think placing the Persian Wars in a context does matter, because it brings up, for me, the interesting issue of how the Greeks saw them. So let's go on to this now. And there are going to be a couple of heresies in here, I warn you now. The Persian Wars come to be one of the three most widely used topoi in law court speeches of the 4th century, the age from which our extant forensic speeches hail. There are frequent allusions in forensic oratory to the great deeds of the Athenians' ancestors in the Persian Wars, how they stood fast against the threat of Persian oppression, how they fought for Greek autonomy against all odds to preserve freedom and the democratic system. We hear that today. These allusions are used rhetorically to try to persuade a jury to find against the prosecutor or the defendant in a trial. For example, we might get the line, "Gentlemen of the jury, your ancestors who fought at Marathon would be turning in their graves now if they thought you might find this man innocent. But his actions show he is willing to conspire with traitors." Or another line, "Gentlemen of the jury, my ancestors fought at Marathon. They believed in fighting for freedom and our lifestyle, as do I. And all my life I've emulated them, so you must find me innocent now." Well, we'll talk more about law and especially the use of rhetorical tricks in court in later lectures. But you can see how the Persian Wars era is alluded to, especially Marathon. These are very much ideals of the classical Greeks, of course, as they look back on a bygone age. Given how the classical Greek world was ripped apart by the Peloponnesian War, and then eventually how that classical Greek world fell under Macedonian hegemony in 338. That was the end of Greek autonomy. The two other periods that are also frequently exploited in oratory are the Age of the Trojan War and the Pisistrated Tyranny. The Trojan War, as we've seen, was a triumph of West over East, as was the Persian War period. The Pisistrated Tyranny was used to show the benefits of democracy rather than tyranny. Think of what the statue of Harmodius and Aristogiton was meant to symbolize. Think about how the drinking song is factually inaccurate to make them champions of democracy. Again then, we have the ideals of the classical Greeks looking back on a previous era, that of the archaic and even pre-archaic Trojan War. The Greeks of these times were the ancestors of our classical Greeks, and they set all sorts of standards that people of the classical age should aspire to, given, as I said, how Greece was ripped apart in the Peloponnesian War. Tens of thousands of men died. The economy was shattered. Life would never be the same again. This isn't serene. This isn't classical. And then we have that loss of freedom and autonomy to Macedonia later in the 4th century. The greatness of the Persian Wars cannot be put at the start of what will be such a dismal period in Greek history. Further, Thucydides spent some time discussing a civil war in Corcyra that broke out in 428. For him, this civil war was a turning point in the decline in morality. Family member was pitted against family member. The commonly accepted meanings of words and even actions changed. For example, selfish acts of aggression were now seen as courageous acts. Moderation was seen as unmanly, and it was okay to plot behind people's backs. To Thucydides, Corcyra, or rather this Corcyrian stasis, this civil war, set the standard for depravity in the Peloponnesian War and in warfare after it. And he's right. In 415, Euripides produced his Trojan Women. This was set in Troy after the city fell to the Greeks. Death and destruction are everywhere as the Greeks go on a rampage. So again, there's this horrible decline in morality arising from their actions. But Euripides has transposed this decline in morality and this rising depravity onto the Trojan War era from his own times, from the era of the Peloponnesian War when he was living. So the Archaic period becomes almost something of a golden age. And that's why defeating the Persians is a fitting conclusion to it. Now we'll leave the Archaic period behind. And in our next lecture, we begin the Classical. As with the term Archaic, we'll see that calling the period we're about to enter Classical may conceal a lot of what is actually going on. I've hinted at this in the last few minutes. We also turn now in more detail to our third topic, imperialism. We begin with the Delian League, the confederacy of allies that Athens put together in 478, out of which arose an empire. It was this league that the Spartans came to view with great concern and fear, and it was their attitude that led to the Peloponnesian War. This was the greatest and most costly war ever, according to the contemporary writer Thucydides. I'll meet you in there very soon. Thank you.